are watching School Psych Podcast. I'm Rachel. I'm a school psychologist in Maryland, here with my friend Eric. We are down Rebecca. She is traveling, and I think she got stuck in on a plane in a delay, something of that nature. So send her positive thoughts, and hopefully, she won't be too exhausted by the end of that adventure. We don't have a guest tonight. We just figured we would chat a little bit, catch up. If we have any live viewers tonight, figure out maybe where we want the season to go. We have some guests in mind. We have, Dr. Vanderhayden coming next episode, and she's like the best ever, and we're just a Vanderhayden groupie, so I'm really excited for that. So just a kind of a very informal kind of chat tonight. We might not take the whole hour. We'll just kind of see where it goes and see what people are up to and give you updates on what we're up to. And I'm home. I just acquired COVID recently. So that's like my little update there, that I've been on quarantine or isolation, and now I'm masking for the next 5 days. So be careful you sit next to at IEP meetings, because they might have COVID and not, let people know that. So beware. But anyways, I'm going to pass it over to you, Eric, to introduce yourself and maybe tell people how they could participate tonight if they are tuning in.
Yes. I just feel awful too, Rachel. But it's going around, right? And I am always happy to wear a mask too. So, I think I was the last person wearing a mask in my workplace. And then I stopped wearing the mask and I got COVID like the next day or something. So it was, I don't know, it's too bad. But hopefully you're on the mend and feeling better. And hopefully Rebecca isn't too stuck traveling to trying to get back home. So, but I'm Eric. I am a school psychologist in the state of Connecticut. And we're excited to just be here and talk about the upcoming season, what we've got going on, perhaps some of our interests in the field of school psychology. And if you're listening live, you certainly can chime in with topics that you'd like us to cover, or perhaps even a guest that you think might be interesting for us to interview. We're certainly open to having folks share things that are of interest to them in the field. And if you are watching live, you can chime in via the chat box on the YouTube video if you're actually watching us. And if you're listening in, you can reach us on Facebook, X, formerly Twitter, and Instagram. And so reach out to us on one of those social media channels. And I can't get used to the X thing.
Are people calling it X now or Twitter? Like, I don't know. It shows X on my phone, but I don't know how to.
Right, same. And I haven't logged in since my phone updated the app. So it's been a while.
Yeah. You're having a silent protest there. You're not engaging. But I will say, we'll just go off on some tangents and whatever, but that reminded me that I saw something cool and interesting on Twitter and shared with you. And I don't know if anybody else had seen that, but Matt Burns and Katie Mackey and Jeremy Misiak. I hope I'm saying names right. It was posted on Twitter that they got like a $1.something million grant to investigate SLD. And so I saw that floating around Twitter, and that looked super awesome. They were looking at methodology of SLD between like Texas and Florida, diagnostic criteria, outcomes. It's like a longitudinal 4-year study to really dive into what the heck we're doing with SLD. So just side note, I thought that was interesting. And I feel like all of them, we've had Matt and Katie on before. And so maybe to come to talk about that one would be a good episode.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. I was very happy when you sent me the link to that article, and certainly excited for them as colleagues and practitioners in the field. This is, it's about time we're trying to figure this thing out. So that's great. And I've recently been corresponding with Jack Fletcher, who co-wrote a paper with Jeremy Misiak for the Texas Association of Special Education. I think it's a fantastic paper on assessment and SLD and understanding sort of our roles in that assessment and a really good scientific methodology and process. So I'm hoping that Connecticut will have Jack come and talk this year. So crossing my fingers, we're just corresponding right now. But speaking of all that, so my state recently, we all have various methodologies for identifying SLD, and Connecticut is an RTI state or MTSS state. And some states are still using the discrepancy model and some states are using PSW. And obviously, whatever state you're in, you know, we encourage you to follow your state guidelines, whether or not, you know, the process seems cumbersome or needs work. But certainly do your best to make change in your state as well. If your state's process is not very scientific, but obviously follow your state's guidelines. But to that regard, in Connecticut, I think it was last year, there was a court case and some folks in the state felt that Connecticut was remiss in not adopting the PSW approach. So we had been a discrepancy state up until about 2008, 2009. And then we adopted MTSS, RTI. And so in this current court case, and I'm not sure whether it just set legal precedent or whether it impacted a specific law, but there are folks suggesting that we need to adopt PSW, and that was a part of why the case was lost. So I don't know all the details, but to that end, we have a number of folks coming to Connecticut to speak, and I'm hoping that Jack Fletcher will be one of them, virtually, not in person, and Ryan McGill, and perhaps Stefan Dabrowski. And we also have Dawn Flanagan and I believe Jack Naglieri. I'm not sure if everybody's scheduled yet, but to talk about various aspects of this. So it's definitely something that's intrigued me. And I know, Rachel, you and I have talked a lot about this stuff. And you've done a lot of work in your district about this as well. So just something that's kind of coming up in Connecticut and coming up on my radar to start focusing on more and more and talking about as well.
Yeah, and I think that's so important for psychs in your state to be aware of what is going on with these types of conversations when they're happening and when associations or when law or state regs are being written and coded. Once it's in there, it's really hard to make changes. And so I feel like if you have to be up to speed on what's going on, because very quickly something can get pushed through and then all of a sudden you have this new thing and it might not be ideal. And I know we've had various people talk about like different SLD models, and through listening to all those people and reading all this stuff, like I've just, you know, to the point that like, I just feel like SLD is a hot mess and nobody has the answer to SLD and nobody's going to have the answer to SLD because I feel like it's a flawed construct and it's a flawed thing. But it's in the law and it is what it is. And that's part of our job is doing that. But yeah, I've come out kind of against that PSW approach because of all the approaches, like there's a lot of evidence that doesn't really work any better than any other model and maybe worse than some models. And it's so time intensive. So yeah, that would concern me, Eric, if I were you. And no offense to all the people, we've had lots of people come on the podcast who have talked about PSW and have been creators of models of PSW. And I think they're awesome and that's great. But yeah, as far as SLD, I'm not a PSW fan after hearing all the different things and reading all the different things. So yeah, if my state was like, oh, well, things like we're going to dip our toe into shifting to PSW, I think I would be a little bit alarmed, Eric. So I'm glad that you're at least, you know, you're informed and up to speed. And I know you'll, you know, do a good job of making sure that all the other psychs are aware of what's going on before it gets kind of set in stone.
Yeah, thank you. I totally agree. Like, you're right. When laws are written, they're hard to change regarding ed code, right? And if they're not always based on science. They're not always based, as we've seen through reading, the reading wars, the science of reading, the curriculum wars. Things get embedded that aren't helpful and perhaps can be harmful. And so we really do need to be aware and advocate as best we can
It's the same thing with, like you said, like parallels there with curriculum and instruction. And so my district is going to be adopting a new reading curriculum, and I'm excited for that. And I think they're going to make a good choice. I hope they make a good choice. But they recently adopted a math curriculum, and that's rolling out this year. And I don't think that that looks like it was a good choice. Who am I to say? But I just know that, you know, you spend how many millions of dollars on it, that's going to be here for a while. You know, the district invests in the curriculum, invests in something, they're not going to just throw it out the next year. So like that, they're in it for the long haul, for better or for worse. But yeah, I kind of wish that, you know, I don't know what process they used, but with the reading stuff, I was able to worm my way onto the committee to at least like fill out the rubric and have some say and see what's going on. For the initial, there's kind of like different tiers that it works its way through with eliminating vendors and things. So I was involved in that, but the math, I was not aware that they were doing it. And so now I have like, oh man, they picked something and I don't know. It is what it is.
Yeah. Right. And we can't clone Dr. Vander Hayden and have her on that committee, right? As much as we'd love to.
I wish.
Speaking of, she's coming up soon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm excited. Pick her brain. But she's always very careful. I don't think that publicly she would say one thing against like a product or this or methodology, because she's just like, you know, she's super professional and respectful. And I don't want her to like tear into something, but you know, she'll outline what's evidence-based, and then I can take that and be like, this is what the research says, and I can look at this program and say that's not following the things that we know it should follow. So and then back to like the SLD stuff, like I need to check out this court case that you're talking about in Connecticut. I often wonder what school district is going to die on the SLD hill, because it's not a hill that I would be willing to die on, because I feel like nobody can reliably win an SLD court case because SLD is so flawed and so gray that if I were a district,
right,
I think I would just like give the parent whatever they wanted within, you know, as far as like SLD or not SLD, like just, I don't think that that's a fight that you're going to win because it's so ambiguous. It's
right.
But I don't know. Then, so I'm curious what that court case is.
Yeah. I'll send you it'll take me a second, but I'll send you stuff on it. We talked about it at our annual long range planning meeting, and our delegate had most recent court cases printed out for us. And, you know, they often involve IEEs as well. And the IEE often disagrees with the results of the school psychologist. So, we deal with those things. And that's not to pit us against our clinician colleagues or anything. But sometimes in these litigious battles or complicated cases, you often find somebody who just says, no, the child needs all of these things and, you know, in a specialized placement in a special school. And, you know, and you're like, wait, I'm not sure we're on that page yet or on that step yet. But so I think it was one of those kinds of cases. So.
Yeah, I had an advocate in the past that I don't think that they requested an IEE, which for anybody watching that doesn't know, individualized education evaluation, right? Like the district paying for that private eval because they're contesting.
Yes. Independent.
Independent. That's it. Thank you. The advocate went and wrote her own report, which was funny because I don't think her background certainly wasn't like anything that we do. Her background was she's in education, some capacity, but this report that I got back was like so bizarre and looked like somebody who had read a lot of psych reports over their lifetime, but then was like trying, like clearly hadn't been trained in how to do that. So, you get variable quality from these, from people writing reports out in the world. I guess you don't need to have a psych license or degree to write a report. So there you go.
So the advocate wrote a psychoed type report based on the background and summarizing the testing, maybe from other practitioners.
It was she titled it. It wasn't like titled psychoed report, but it was titled like reading diagnostic screening evaluation or something kind of funky, and it was just a farce and a platform to say that this child requires a private private placement type of thing. And so they attempted to do a test and couldn't get they picked a test that would not be appropriate for the student to take anyways, because we established that the kid can't read. But she gave a test to see how, and so couldn't participate. And so like attempted a test, but then couldn't do it, which we already knew. And then wrote, therefore, this child needs a placement in a private school.
Wow.
That was a fun one. Yeah.
Interesting. Certainly interesting. And I don't know, you know, I guess in the private sector, you can do all that. It makes me think of like consent for evaluation. Are you licensed to evaluate? You know, there's ethical principles here. Right. Yeah.
As well as
legal.
It was interesting. Yeah. And I say, it's funny because I just saw on like a Facebook, I think it was a Science of Reading page, somebody posted like, who can diagnose dyslexia? And all these comments come in about, you know, neuropsychologists only, or pediatricians only, like all these different, totally different answers. And I'm kind of like thinking about it. I'm like, honestly, I think that anyone could probably just throw out the term dyslexia. I don't think there's any kind of copyright or legal framework. I don't think that a psych board saying you can and you can't, like you neuropsychs go ahead and the other psychs I think it's just a kind of a free for all with a lot of this stuff, but I don't know.
Yeah. And I certainly, I believe, and I think at least in the state of Connecticut, school psychologists are expected and trained in identifying all 13 areas of disability under IDEA. So if dyslexia is there, school psychologists are supposed to be able to identify it.
There was that federal memo that came out that it was like, basically like, stop saying you cannot do dyslexia.
I think it was,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to finish up. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, I think it was similar to ADHD 20 years ago. You know, we had that. Oh, and only a doctor can identify it. And
how is that in Connecticut now? Can you all do that? ADHD?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So I remember when I was in New York and when I was in North Carolina, I don't know if it was right or wrong, but they did say like, we need a doctor to sign off on it. And I know that in the, like, if that's the case, then the district probably has to pay for it. They weren't.
Right.
But when I came to Maryland, you know, Maryland has specifically said school psychs can diagnose ADHD. Mm. So that's what I do.
And interestingly, I think we used to separate it at 504s and expecting families to identify that through their medical professional. But we now, at least in a number of states and a number of districts, are testing under 504 as well. So that's a whole, probably another can of worms for some school psychologists in some districts that, but I believe we'll be expected to test under 504 at some point if we're not yet.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, we in Maryland here, at least in my district, I do 504 evaluations. And because 504 is so, there was like a 2016 to that, I don't know, there was an update or a clarification to 504 federally that came out mm-hmm. that said, like, stop being such gatekeepers of 504, like stop like denying 504. If right. a kid has a suspected impairment and you know, it intermix the term disability and impairment, like again, it doesn't need to be a diagnosed disability. It can be seen as like some sort of, so we're very broad in that, you know, we could say, you know, poor working memory, 504, or poor attention span, 504. Mm. It doesn't need to be a diagnosis of ADHD. It can be like the teacher has concerns for attention span and here's some classroom data to the end. And I don't know if that's like that other places, but.
Okay.
What's that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, you know, it makes sense that we would assess regardless, because we're not testing for a 504, and we're not testing for an IEP. We're assessing the child to determine whether or not they have special needs and require support, you know, identifying a disability, whether the outcome is a 504 plan or an IEP or just informal interventions or tiered interventions. Regardless, we're assessing the child to see what level of support and level of need. So yeah, that makes sense to me. Rather than testing for a 504 or testing for an IEP, we're testing to see what the child needs.
Yeah, and I usually phrase it that like we're like, I'm gathering information to help the team make a determination on this. Like if the mm-hmm. referral question is, if the team is saying like, I suspect a disability, could this be LD? Then I'm like, okay, I will go forth and summarize all the information to help you make that determination. And so, yeah, it's not right. like we're making that determination, but we're like the synthesizers of information related to that question.
Yeah.
But Eric, I wanted to ask about, so Connecticut uses MTSS. I, you know, used in my intern year in Las Vegas, they were shifting over to like a full-blown RTI MTSS. And so I was involved in some of that and saw that during my year. But that's the only place that I've really kind of seen it in action. And what I've seen most of the times is that it's like really hard to do RTI, MTSS, you know, strong and well, because it takes so much support from people that are not us. You know, we're relying on teachers, we're relying on teams, right. we're relying on schools and curriculums and things. And then you get into the situation where maybe these things haven't happened. And then do you say, no, you don't have a disability because your teacher didn't collect the data. And like, there's so many, I feel like RTI is really good in theory if we could do it. So mm-hmm. like, is Connecticut doing it well? And what is like, how does that work?
That's a good question. I will say yes and no. I have to say I'm super proud of the team that I work with, because I think we do RTI well. But I also will say I understand why it doesn't get done well sometimes. I'm in a small elementary school for part of my day or my work week, and we have a really strong teaching staff. And we have interventionists, and we have strong special ed teachers who review and are participate in the pre-referral process. And so it takes work, though. You know, we have interventionists and tutors who are doing the support work, along with strong regular ed classroom teachers doing tier one and tier two. And then our special ed teachers and some other interventionists are doing tier two and tier three work. And so by the time we get to the referral for, if it's LD, really, you know, that's the area that we do this for primarily. By the time we get to that referral, our special ed teachers are pretty aware of the kids' needs, what interventions have been tried. They're pretty good at gathering data. So they work pretty hard in that process. I know in some schools it's you know, we talk about separating it as that's a regular ed initiative. This is special ed. We're overworking our special ed teachers. And I will say my special ed teachers on my team work really hard, as do my regular ed teachers on my team. So I think we do a good job of it, though. And I suppose at some point, if our special ed teachers are taxed, you know, to the breaking point of, you know, being overly stressed, something would have to give. And of course, it would probably be the MTSS part because they need to service their kids, right? So, you know, I see where that can unravel. You know, you need to have interventionists. You need to have people who have the time to provide the intervention. And you need to have people who understand instruction, right? You need to have people who are learned and skilled in the science of reading and the science of math, and who understand the scope and sequence of reading development and math development, and not just saying, well, we do Wilson here, so we gave the kid Wilson, or we do such and such math, and we put the kid on the Chromebook during the intervention time, but he hasn't learned anything. You know, he's still at, you know, a first grade level, and he's in fourth grade, so we need to go to testing. He must be LD. And there's so many holes in our intervention process. So I see how that happens. But I think a good team and a team that has the time can really make a lot of progress in the RTI, within the RTI structure. But there's so many things, variables that are required to keep that piece, you know, implement it with fidelity.
For sure. I mean, I'm thinking about my district and we can't even get bus drivers. Like, we have kids that just aren't coming to school because we don't have bus drivers, you know? And so we do have like people that are trained for interventions, but more often than not, they're pulled to substitute teach a class for a teacher that's out sick, or they have to long-term sub for a teacher that is just a vacant position. And that's tough because then we get, these referrals that there isn't data or interventions on. And like,
right.
I don't know what to do with that.
But yeah. And that's the sort of the thought I used to say, you know, and I didn't invent this. You know, lots of people have said this in the past, but, you know, when the only tool we have is a hammer, every problem is a nail, right? Becomes a nail. And we did that with special ed, right? The only intervention that we had was special ed. So every problem was a learning disability, right? Or a special ed issue. And so, you know, unfortunately, I think, you know, philosophically and ethically, I don't want to call a kid disabled when they're not, right? I don't want to say a child has a learning disability when we could do better with early reading instruction and intervention, or, you know, when we were teaching particular parts of curricula 25 years ago that are now known to really not be very scientific. But that's how, you know, how things often end up, when we don't have the tools and the resources.
Yeah. I so often, wonder, like, if we did things correctly, tier one, you know, how many referrals, like true referrals, will we actually get if, you know, that triangle was structured the way it's supposed to. But I had and I'm sure that I talked to you, Eric, before, and I don't know if I brought it up on an episode, but I had in a previous year, a little friend who entered second grade and hadn't been in school at all. So no kindergarten, no first, so no instruction, and a high number of absences too. So I came across him in February of the school year, and the teacher brought to like an RTI team, and the team wanted to refer for SLD testing. And the reasoning was that, you know, I've been teaching 30 years. I've never seen a kid this low. He doesn't know letters. He doesn't know sounds. He can't read at all. And nothing that I've tried has worked. And so, of course, I'm like, well, are we in an intervention? And of course, there's no interventions to be had. And so everyone's just like, so I'm like, well, what are we going to do? So you just want to test him because we have no interventions and he's super low. And that was kind of the consensus. So I said, okay, how about this? Give me some time to work with this kid. And, you know, I'm only at the school 3 days a week. But I recruited a special ed teacher and, you know, got the teacher child to read in 100 lessons, the Engelmann book, which is like golden. Mm-hmm. And I love it. And I taught both my kids with that and said, okay, I'm just going to, whenever I can, I'm going to pull him and I'm going to do a lesson. It's high quality, you know, one-on-one instruction. And, you know, we'll see in a month or two where he's at. And so I pulled him when I could, and a special ed teacher pulled him when I wasn't on campus. And that little kid like made amazing progress. And I was just so proud of him. And he, it was like the best, it was the best feeling That's ever awesome. Because, I mean,
yeah.
We only got to lesson like 65 or something by the end of the school year because he was absent so much and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But by then he was reading paragraphs and sounding things out and doing great. And so, you know, I picked him up the next year and he, I was like, oh, how are we going to be over the summer? Are we going to lose all that? And he came back and it was like, I mean, he must have read over the summer. He must have worked at it and it was just great. And all of a sudden, nobody, you know, there's no more concerns about, oh, we want him tested. We want him tested. At the same time, like, I wanted to be like, see, like, this isn't magic. Like, if you give them appropriate instruction, these kids don't need to be in special ed. And I'm not sure that that's sunk in because I don't know if people think it's kind of a fluke or they've just moved on to another problem or anything, but I wanted people to like realize that, hey, this, we thought this kid was severely disabled and look at this. Now he's like on grade level. Like I brought him up to grade level. Like it's amazing. But yeah, so it just makes me wonder, what percentage of our kids are truly disabled and what are victims of environmental circumstances, poor instruction and all that stuff. But I hoped that would like show people like, hey, you can do this. But at the end of the day, I don't think it really changed any minds. They just moved on to the next problem and the next kid that they want to test it. But sorry, that's my rant.
No, that's good. Right. You know, and what do you do in circumstances like that? Right. If you have a child who doesn't fit the typical mold, and we certainly can't control all those extraneous variables that are, you know, the rule outs or things, you know, then, we may need to wait and do intervention. Yeah, I love that comment from GV 0861, inability doesn't equate to disability, inability is simply lack of skills. Yes, and that's what intervention is, right? Skill by treatment interaction. And so, I love that you did the intervention, Rachel. That's great. And I think we as school psychs are certainly capable of doing that. If we can find the time, perhaps our time is better used doing some of those interventions than just testing or just, you know, putting out fires. If we can do the same kind of intervention behaviorally as well.
Yeah. And it kind of makes me sad because I feel like we saved this kid from special education, right? I feel like we did a good service. Not that, you know, kids like it's the end of the world, but we want kids to not be in special education if we can help it. We want to service them through general education. That's the goal. Oftentimes it comes down to lack of materials, lack of training, lack of time, lack of all these things. And, you know, we can't on our own. We need a working system. We can't on our own like pick and choose like who we're gonna save, who we're gonna do this. And you mentioned behavioral stuff too. Like I went into a classroom recently and saw a kid that everybody's like, oh man, he can't be here. Like this is we need a more restrictive setting. And I'm looking at this kid and thinking, like, no, this kid has a lot of potential. This kid, if we can intervene, if we can do this, and I'm thinking about, you know, how I would set up the reinforcement schedule and how I would do all this. Mm-hmm. And I'm piloting things and he's responding and I did timeout procedure and and really exciting stuff. But then at the end of the day, I know what needs to happen, but I don't have a set of hands to do it. I'm at that school 2 days a week. You know, is me going in and working with that kid 15 minutes here or there, is that going to solve the problem? No, he needs somebody to work with him consistently until that's faded away and then we can be more independent and stuff. So yeah, it's just frustrating to me that I feel like in a perfect world, if we had access to high quality stuff and not all the nonsense that gets flooded into schools every day,
right.
That we could make such a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And thinking of, you know, in Connecticut, we have kindergartners who start at age four sometimes, if they're our cutoff date right now, I believe is the end of December. So they could be 4 years, 9 months, 4 years, 8 months old, starting kindergarten, and they're expected to follow an academic routine for, you know, the day. And if they've had no preschool, then they're going to be academically behind some of their peers, and they're likely going to be socially and behaviorally behind some of their peers. And you have some kids who might be 5 years, 9 months old, 5 years, 10 months old, you know, pushing six. And there's such a huge variability between a four-year-old and an almost six-year-old in terms of maturity and social skills. Yes. And yeah.
That reminds me of that study that looked at the birthdays of ADHD. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? So then the kids with those later birthdays who were older for their grade were far less likely to be diagnosed with ADHD than the young ones.
Yeah.
And that was, it wasn't just like this, you know, this birthday is, it was determined by the district cutoff, you know, it was how close to the district cutoff were these kids, it increased their chances of being diagnosed. It's crazy.
Yeah. So I do think, I'm pretty sure we are changing our enrollment age in the state here. So I think we're going to, I think kids have to be five by September. I might be wrong, but I think my screen's freezing here. But GV, if you're still listening and you have any info on that, I think that's going to change for next year. And honestly, I'm predicting that, as I think most people in the state are, that that's going to make a big difference for behavioral and social. Yes, as GVs, not to mention the diversity in socioeconomic and cultural factors. Yeah.
And that's why I'm liking a lot of a lot of curriculums now are kind of understanding that kids are coming in from different places. And so there's these curriculums that are focused on knowledge building. So instead of just a worksheet and assuming that a kid knows this concept, like first there's this teaching of this social studies concept or the science concept, and then the lesson builds upon that. So you go into all the lessons first, you teach the content first, you don't just assume. And I think that needs to happen.
Yeah.
So five by September starting next year. I think that that's our cutoff too in Maryland. I think you need to be five by like September or something. I don't see four-year-olds for sure in my classrooms. We have four-year-old preschool, but not kindergarten.
Yeah, and I think similarly, we have developmental delay that is the cutoff date for developmental delay is by age six. So prior to the child turning six, while they're still five, they must be reassessed. And you must determine whether or not they have a continued disability and eligibility. And I believe that is changing. That's something our state association of school psychologists is advocating for. And I think I may be wrong, and GV may know as well. CONCASE, which is our association for special ed administrators, which is a really wonderful association here in Connecticut, and a very strong association. I believe has also advocated for that. And I think the law may be changing. I have to talk to our lobbyists, but we had asked them to really see if they could push into that and see what's going on and help process that if need be.
Yeah, I like these conversations because it makes you realize how different things are state by state. So here in Maryland, it used to be by six, and then in our county, like the different counties could set different cuts. But we pushed it up now, to the state max, which was eight. I know federally they have the ability to go up to age nine with the DD label, but I do like having that wiggle room that if, if you're not sure what the disability is, or you feel like you need a little bit more intervention before you put a different label on there, or you feel like they're close to making the gains and then they can be dismissed, like having that later cutoff for DD is helpful. When I was in Nevada, they had to, by six, and that was rough because you had kindergartners and then you had to assess them in like kindergarten or LD when maybe they haven't had instructions. Nuts.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in my district, we have a large population of Spanish speaking bilingual students too. And so if we're trying to look at LD assessment, you know, we're also trying to look at assessing the child in their language one, you know, their native language or their first language. And we are limited on the assessments, right? You have the WJ achievement in Spanish and then a couple of cognitive measures in Spanish. You know, I'm not sure they're going to give us the data that we need when we're making an LD decision. You know, we need to have the instructional piece and the intervention piece and all of that. So, yeah.
All these tough questions, and I don't know the answers to some of these, but yeah, the comment about, you know, changing the starting age without increasing the DD age, that's going to, yeah, that's problematic potentially.
Yeah. Right.
But,
you know, this is a great conversation. I always love talking just with you, Rachel, about SLD stuff, because I know we could talk for hours and hours about
this. I know. We should have known that we would go down the SLD rabbit hole, you and I. Of course, that's where right. we end up.
But, you know, I'm thinking about upcoming guests and things that I would love to talk about. Perhaps AI and the influence on the school psych community might be a good topic. And I have a professor friend, colleague who has reached out to me, John, I think his last name is Skakachia. I might be pronouncing that wrong. But we've talked a little bit and corresponded, and he is doing some work in that field in psychology. And so, you know, I'm going to talk to him, sometime soon, and, would love to see if he, you know, he'd like to be a guest. He's doing some interesting work in AI and as it applies to research and psychology. So
the AI stuff is super, super interesting to me. I have a principal that's like really into it as far as, and I'm a little bit hesitant with it, as with any new thing that maybe hasn't been tried and true. But how he's using it is not like to instruct students, which is good probably, but he's using it for a lot of, scheduling and paperwork and streamlining things. And so, yeah, I can see that within report writing maybe, or present level writing, or that there's a lot of maybe uses for this. Like this particular principal, he'll say that like he puts things into ChatGPT to respond to parents sometimes, and we'll get back, you know, a nice, concise, well-written response. And then he, you know, so he plugs things into ChatGPT to check himself and to have a, kind of another set of eyes, have the AI eyes looking at things. And so, yeah, I have to wonder, like, would AI, you know, help write portions of our reports or proofread our reports, or, you know, if we just gave it a bunch of data, like summarize it. I don't know. I think that that's worth looking at. More hesitant with using it like directly with students to like teach them or write lessons and things like that. But I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting. I joined a webinar over the summer. Rebecca Brandstetter, who's been a guest here, the Thriving School Psych. And she was talking about using it as GV mentioned on the chat. For assistance with goals and summarizing things. And so I'd never used it before. And she said, you know, she gave us like a little lesson to try to, you know, ask it to do this and this. And I was so impressed with just the fact that, you know, I tend to write more technical reports, and my, you know, in talking with my boss, sometimes it's, you know, things that are legally defensible, but I would like to write things that are more user-friendly for parents. And so perhaps my summaries could be written in more common language. And so I put in some things and said, you know, can you write this in a more easily understandable manner? And it did. It summarized things and kind of got rid of the big words. And I was pleasantly surprised. So
that's interesting. I didn't think about that. But yeah, cutting and pasting your summary in there and be like, write this on a fifth grade level or something. Like if it could do that, I bet you it could. Yeah. That's neat.
Yeah.
I tend to be too wordy, and so I need to be more concise. I wonder if ChatGPT can help consolidate my ramblings. But, yeah, wow. I was trying to think of things that I would want to talk about this season. And for sure, I think that SLD study that we gleaned on Twitter, I had some things on some like FBA stuff that I would like to get into. I know we've talked too about finding somebody on like alternate assessments, like state alternate assessments and guidelines or assessment of children with really significant needs and disabilities and how to do that, or assessment with kids that are deafblind or things of that nature. And so diving into that, and we've looked around and tried to find people for that. And I don't think at the time we came up with any that either responded to our emails or anybody that looked like they would be good, but maybe that's worth revisiting. But SLD study, yeah, GV, we were talking earlier about Matt Burns and Mackie and Misiak are doing a longitudinal SLD. Yeah, are doing a longitudinal SLD study over 4 years in Texas and in Florida. That's a really large study looking at methodology of SLD, outcomes of SLD. And so we're excited, and maybe about 5 years we'll hear back from them and or get them on the podcast to get a little bit of a preview.
Yeah, I'll send you the article, GV. Rachel sent it on to me, but a multi-million dollar grant, it looked like, or at least 1.7 million or something. So it looks pretty significant. Yes, another book for you to buy. Yes, we're all in the same club. GV and I talk about this a lot. So
awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. I don't really have anything else, Eric. I know we're just kind of shooting the breeze tonight. But next episode, we'll be back with Vander Hayden, which I'm always just so giddy about. I have to control myself, but
I know. I feel like I love some of our repeat guests. I mean, we've had Celeste Malone, and I'd love to have Dr. Sherry Proctor back. I'd love to have, you know, Byron McClure anytime, and Kelsey Reed, you know, and Charles Barrett. And, you know, I want us to continue talking about social justice issues. And certainly then there's so many new folks too in the field. So
it's so hard to choose.
It is. Right. Right. So, but, you know, a couple years ago, or maybe just last year, sorry, you know, well, a couple years ago we had grad students on. And then I think last year we talked about maybe having a group of grad students on again to talk about their current experience coming out of COVID, studying during COVID or interning during COVID. And
It's wild. So, my intern right now, I asked her, you know, of course I was in the schools and I had an intern when COVID happened. And I asked her, where was she when COVID hit? And she was like, I was a junior in high school. And I was like, I feel so old. But, you know, now we have school psychologists who are coming into the field who their learning was, you know, their high school learning was disrupted by COVID. And I'm just like, wow.
Impacted. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to drop Nick Shannon's name and just say we'd love to have him on. You know, he's been a longtime, audience member, and he posts so much about the field. And so maybe we can get Nick to come on and talk about school. And you know, he's been a longtime school psych fan even before he was a grad student. So lots of good stuff.
Yeah, so I hope that people maybe send us a message or post on Facebook or Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, and let us know ideas. We do sometimes get suggestions for guests, and we definitely have conversations about that and look into people and send emails and see if we can snag people. So yeah, please do that so that it stays relevant and interesting, because otherwise, you know, the three of us just choose our favorites and who we want to chat with. And then, you know, some people might, you know, want something a little bit different, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And also Andrea Klein, our new NAS president. It'd be great to keep that tradition of having our NAS presidents come on as well. So,
yes. And Eric, you just got a piece. You all got a piece accepted for NAS. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So Courtney Hugenin, who's on our communications committee, where Rachel and I were a part of for the National Association, and is a delegate for the New York State Association and is a huge friend to our Connecticut Association. Courtney and Tom Brandt, who is our delegate here in Connecticut, were talking about intervening for high-end absenteeism and doing like FBAs for, you know, intervention and assessment for absenteeism. And so we were talking and they said, hey, maybe we could try to present at NASP. So we put a proposal together and we were accepted to present at the NASP conference in February. So so that's exciting. So we're talking about from assessment to intervention, trying to address high absenteeism and doing sort of a FBA for, you know, for attendance as well.
Awesome. So you're locked in then. You're definitely going, right?
Yes. So I'm planning to go.
Yeah. Awesome. I still haven't quite like decided, but I do want to go. So, I mean, I would not be presenting on anything, but I just like to go and geek out. So,
yeah.
Okay.
It's so much fun, and it's always a blast having you and Rebecca, you know.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, sorry,
totally.
I'm like fun. 10 seconds behind you.
No, yeah, I don't know who it is, but somebody's lagging, and sorry. So I had a thought, and now, I was looking at the time, and I remember when we started off, I'm like, I'm not feeling too good, and Rebecca's not here. We'll probably just chat for a couple minutes, and then we'll get off, and here it is, like, 9 o'clock. Of course, I should have known that you and I could just, like, we could keep going, and just about right. random things and tangents and SLV rabbit holes, but good time.
Yeah.
Good time. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, good. So... Yes. So yeah, 2 weeks from now, Dr. Vander Hayden, and we're still working on, I've been lazy, honestly. I've got a list of like some topics and things that I need to investigate and find some guests and things. But we'll get an actual calendar out for the year. And then, but yeah, for sure. Let us know if you have any thoughts and we can add that to the list. So thanks everybody. Have a good one.
Thanks, everyone.